Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. If you have Labor Day weekend travel plans, don't rush to the roads this morning.
If you are heading out today, maybe wait until the afternoon, late evening. That's going to be the best time to avoid the traffic. The good news, if you're driving, gas prices are looking pretty good right now. It's $3.32. That is down from $3.81 from this time last year.
ABC's Morgan Norwood. 15 ISIS fighters killed Thursday in a joint U.S.-Iraqi raid in western Iraq. No civilian casualties reported. 5 Americans hurt in combat, 2 in falls, and all are in stable condition. Police have arrested a 51-year-old South Carolina man after investigators say he killed a woman who was his roommate and buried her body in a fire pit in his own backyard. 51-year-old Penny Whiteside disappeared in May 2022. Former President Trump's reversal now saying that he will, as a Florida resident, vote no on a ballot measure aiming to overturn the state's near total abortion ban, even though just the day before he indicated the 6-week ban was too restrictive. Hockey fans stunned after NHL star Johnny Gaudreau and his 29-year-old brother Matthew were killed by an alleged drunk driver while riding their bikes in New Jersey Thursday night.
In Ohio and New Jersey, fans with tributes to the Blue Jackets forward of short stature but towering with talent.
Smaller guy, kind of represents like working hard.
There's a lot of good hockey players in South Jersey, and he was probably the best.
Gaudreau played in the NHL for 11 years. In 2022, he signed a 7-year contract with the Blue Jackets for nearly $70 million.
ABC's Mike DeBusky. They may have to make more episodes of Serial. There is a new twist in the case of the podcast featured. Maryland Supreme Court upholding a decision to reinstate Adnan Syed's murder conviction and ordering a new hearing. The court ruling that the 2022 hearing that freed Syed violated the legal rights of the victim's family. Syed remains free. Dave Packer, ABC News.
An unsuspecting driver at a Milwaukee barbershop.
I got an apprentice here shadowing me.
I'm gonna put this hot towel on, man.
About a good 3 minutes, all right?
The apprentice is Donald Driver.
So when you come here, you drive?
Yes.
Your car got seatbelts?
Yeah.
You wear them?
No.
Okay, but why not?
I don't want to.
But did you know you can get a ticket for that?
Mm-hmm.
I'm gonna give you a ticket. Bet you wish you buckle up now.
Oh my God.
Donald Driver can't always be there to remind you.
Take it, click it. There we go.
Click it or tick it.
And let's reduce fatalities on Wisconsin roadways. Sponsored by Wisconsin DOT.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.FM. From the Lakeshore to Lake Winnebago.
Door to Fond du Lac counties.
Northeast Wisconsin is special for many different reasons. I'm Lisa Hale.
And I'm Terry Barr. Family and fun.
Save communities and friends. We're featuring all of it as part of New Wisco Weekend, a news magazine show just for you, and highlighting what makes the Fox Valley and Green Bay area a great place to live.
Join us.
New Wisco Weekend, Saturday mornings at 8, Sundays at 11 on WGBW and WISS and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Slaughterhouses are a big reason for so many toxic algae blooms in Wisconsin in recent years, but it's been 20 years since federal regulations were updated. Mike Moan reports.
In 2021, more than 100 people were sickened by toxic algae, mostly in freshwater. And the number of reported toxic algae outbreaks have increased each year from 2015 to 2023. John Rumpler with Environment America, the group behind the analysis, says that nitrogen, phosphorus, grease, bacteria, and other farm runoff is one of the driving causes.
These industrial-scale operations with hundreds of dairy cows or thousands of hogs, that volume of manure just all too often winds its way to rivers and lakes and streams.
The EPA says exposure to toxic algae can include skin rashes, headaches, vomiting, and pneumonia. Children and pets are especially vulnerable. In the new Census of Agriculture, data show the number of Wisconsin farms is declining, but farm sizes are growing, underscoring concerns about the expansion of industrial agriculture. Rumpler adds, in rural areas, slaughterhouses also are triggering blooms.
It turns out that slaughterhouses, the places where a lot of these animals are brought, also release a huge amount of nitrogen and or phosphorus into our waterways.
Federal regulations for slaughterhouses haven't been updated in 20 years and not since the mid-1970s for smaller facilities. Rumpler says it's encouraging the EPA is now considering new changes to its rules, largely in response to advocacy groups. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, a high near 82. Clear tonight, lows around 60. It'll be breezy out of the northwest, over 25 miles per hour. Sunny and breezy for Sunday with a high near 75. Labor Day Monday, sunshine and highs in the mid-70s.
It's 64 at our studios.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we sit down and talk to labor leaders from all over Wisconsin for our Labor Day celebration. Please join us and happy Labor Day.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel. Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host on this broadcast of the Civic Media stations throughout the state of Wisconsin and beyond. Delighted, honored to have you with me this weekend as we once again talk about all things law-related, government-related, rule of justice promoting, things important to our lives, our livelihoods, every single day in this state, in the United States of America, and on the face of this planet. As always, this weekend, this time of our gathering together for Amicus, a law review, we have an ambitious but achievable agenda. Let me tell you a bit about what we're going to be talking about in this hour and also in the second hour of our broadcast here on Amicus. We're going to begin with some major news coming out of lawyers. Yes, that's right. Lawyers once again writing lots of things this past week in those four major cases pending against Donald Trump, former president, presently a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. We're going to talk about what lawyers on both sides of the aisle in the criminal prosecutions of Donald Trump have filed with courts just this past week. Those four major cases pending in state and federal courts. We're going to talk about exactly what the lawyers on behalf of the prosecution units, the prosecution offices, and also for the defense, for Donald Trump himself, have written and what they have filed with those courts just this past week, advancing as a part of our routine process, our constitutional process in our nation, the notion that through this adversarial process in court, pretrial proceedings as well, the truth comes out and that we ultimately accomplish some sense of justice when there is in fact some disagreement and some advocacy on both sides about what should and should not happen in these cases. That's a part of our system. This past week, lots of lawyers writing about that very process, telling judges what they think about the future of cases in particular, their positions on them. We're going to talk in particular about the major news coming out of that trial, pending right now in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan in the District of Columbia. That's the trial not yet scheduled on her docket that focus on these four major counts against Donald Trump having to do with election interference on January 6th and right before. We know from just this past week two major developments. One of them is that Jack Smith, through the grand jury process, announcing and providing to the court and to the defendant a brand new indictment, actually a superseding indictment, fancy way, a lawyer way of saying a new set of charges, but actually not so new, pared down, reduced in the wake of the Supreme Court decision on immunity. We'll talk about what that new grand jury indictment, that superseding indictment coming out of a new grand jury in the District of Columbia. What does it say? What doesn't it say? What does it mean going forward? And then in news breaking very late just this past week, we will talk about what the lawyers have said, what they have written to Judge Tanya Chutkan, telling her what they think she should do in handling not only this newly returned grand jury indictment, but also dealing generally with the prosecution going forward, both the defense on behalf of Donald Trump and the prosecution, Jack Smith, the special counsel office. Both of them have written to her in the context of a joint report. And we'll talk about exactly what they have said. Needless to say, fully anticipating that they would not get along, that they would not agree with what should happen here. And that's exactly what we saw late this past week when the prosecution and the defense did not agree on what she, the judge, should do in this case. We'll talk about the specifics of what they wrote to her and then talk about what's going to be happening next week in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan as she listens to them in person for the first time since the Supreme Court issued this major, catastrophic, constitution-changing decision on July 1 that established it for the first time in our nation's history that our presidents are in fact kings or could be kings depending upon the exercise of their authorities. No prosecution for many things, presumptive immunities for many official acts, and absolute immunities for things involving the United States Department of Justice. We'll talk about the impacts of that ruling once again upon this new indictment and then what it is that the attorneys for both sides in that case, no trial yet, but pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan, what they have told her in writing, anticipating oral statements about that as soon as this coming week. Then we're also going to talk about what Jack Smith in another jurisdiction, that is the Southern District of Florida, what he has said about the decision there by Judge Eileen Cannon to dismiss that case, arguably embracing the notion presented by the defense that Jack Smith was unconstitutionally appointed and could not prosecute in that case. That case right now pending, as we know, in front of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. We'll talk about what Jack Smith said to them, what he said to them again in writing, his petition, his memorandum, his brief to that 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, what position he is taking, obviously opposing what Eileen Cannon did, describing her actions as being unwarranted, unjustified, unprecedented. We'll talk about that and also anticipate, of course, the defense will also have an opportunity to weigh in on those very issues. That will be coming up in the weeks ahead. There's been some major developments in the Georgia appeal. That case coming out of Fulton County, now pending on appeal to a Fulton County appellate court. Allegations in that matter of racism brought by the defendant, Donald Trump, by his defense counsel, alleging that much of the conduct, or at least some of the conduct, involving Fannie Willis, whose conduct is the subject principally of that appeal, much of that is premised upon racism. We'll talk about what exactly the defense has said about Fannie Willis's statements in the public domain, arguably impacting the trial. And we'll chat about what it is that that means for the future of that case as well in terms of timing. Similarly, no trial set in that case as well. And then finally, some other things written by trial lawyers in that New York hush money case as well. In that case, as you know, Donald Trump found guilty of engaging in violations of New York state law, false statements, fraudulent representations, and representations made by defense counsel just this past week about what the judge should do in that case. He's previously indicated he will not recuse himself, but now this latest attempt to try to get that case out of the state court and into federal court, a petition renewed. Why? Because they've done this before. It has been rejected before by federal courts. They're back again. They filed another petition just this past week seeking to stop the sentencing coming up, presumably in mid-September, week after next, of Donald Trump in that case, seeking to have that state case removed into the federal court. Lots and lots of things being written by lawyers this past week. Lots of filings in all of these cases. We'll talk about all of them in particular. Then we're going to go back to the United States Supreme Court, as we often do, talk about yet another exercise of its emergency docket, and in particular, talk about what it did in connection with the president's latest student debt reduction or forgiveness program. That a major piece of news coming out once again of the United States Supreme Court. a decision not premised upon an exhaustive explanation of reasons. We'll talk about what they did in that particular case. And then we're going to stay in Washington, D.C. and talk about the January 6th event in particular, talking about one of the many, many, many cases still proceeding against various people involved in the attack on the Capitol on January 6th. We'll talk about a Maryland police officer found guilty by a judge, a court trial just this past week. What was his involvement on that day? What did he do? What did the trial judge find? Again, beyond a reasonable doubt. What was he convicted of just this past week? And then more broadly, we're going to be talking about the impact of the other case decided by the Supreme Court not too long ago, several months ago, that Fisher case, chatted a lot about on this broadcast, under Section 1512 of Title 18, the Criminal Code of the United States of America, the court saying, the Supreme Court telling us that to support a prosecution under that statute, got to be talking about documents, papers, materials that were somehow used for the purpose of accomplishing a criminal end. We'll talk about the impact of that Fisher decision upon other cases that are pending against other defendants based upon their involvement also on January 6th. And yes, indeed, that Fisher case also rears its head and sees some daylight in connection with what Jack Smith has done with the superseding indictment through the grand jury. We'll talk about the impact of Fisher upon the Trump prosecution itself, pending once again in front of Tanya Chutkan. Lots of other things going on in district courts around the country. A Louisiana district court just sends a blow to the environmental justice movement with respect to an EPA program. We'll talk about that. Another judge in Texas finding that a program that would advance the immigration interests of undocumented spouses of citizens of the United States of America, that can't proceed. Once again, focusing upon this notion of a judiciary, individual judges, federal judges, finding that executive orders, executive plans cannot go ahead for various reasons, and raising once again, as we often do on this broadcast, the question of why? Why is it that we have presidents of all parties, of all histories, entering executive orders? Why? It's because the Congress is not acting. And then we've got judges also entering the field and likewise making policy decisions, overturning those plans and those executive orders, raising the question, if we've got the executive branch involved in these things, if we've got the judicial branch overturning them or at least issuing opinions on them, where are the people who should be resolving these issues centrally? Where's the Congress of the United States of America? Aren't those the folks, the people we elect, we send to the House of Representatives and to the Senate of the Congress? Where are they in all this? And why is it that the strongest, presumably the most muscular branch of the three, the first article of the Constitution, why is it that in this process we see again this past week, presidents proposing plans overturned by judges and the Congress itself not resolving these major issues in areas that they should, in fact, be addressing? Why is that happening? Well, it's happening again this past week. We'll talk about that Louisiana judge, the Texas judge, and we'll also talk about ballots in America. Some things going on in Nebraska having to do with whether felons can vote in Nebraska, and also, of course, the Wisconsin ballot itself. Some major news coming out of the Wisconsin Election Commission just this past week, having to do with who is on the ballot and who isn't among the presidential candidates. All of that and more as Amicus, a Law Review, continues on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
There are so many traditions built around the Wisconsin Badgers, game day and the mascot, which in 1889 was a real badger. It didn't go well. Eventually, the animal was replaced by a person. An on-campus contest chose the official mascot name, Buckingham U. Badger. Still, Wisconsin's official animal is a badger. But do you know which animal almost earned this title instead? Gray squirrel? White-tailed deer? Black bear? The answer is coming up. The original Badger's nickname is actually associated with lead miners in the state, not the animals. It was the 1820s, and the miners often didn't have shelter in the winters, so they lived like badgers, digging tunnels into the hillsides where they worked. So was there almost another state animal? Yes, the white-tailed deer, which later became the official wildlife animal. But the history surrounding the badgers is a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
This is Amicus, a Law Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host here on Civic Media, both this hour and next hour. As always, in the midst of this very ambitious agenda in the areas of rule of law and justice and government and lots of things having to do with courts and lawyers this weekend, we take your questions and your inquiries. That phone number is 844-967-2789. Once again, 844-967-2789. My terrific producer, Max, also reminds me as well that you can be in touch with us asking those same questions, those same inquiries posed to me and to him through the Civic Media app. Drop us a note, drop us a line, ask about something that's on your mind, or make a comment that we can engage with you in discussions about these various issues here on Amicus, a Law Review. Always delighted to have your involvement in these important discussions of the times of our lives, having to do with the Constitution, the laws of states, of the federal government, and the ways in which the rule of law is applied, sometimes not applied, in our nation. Let us begin with our agenda then on this weekend show of Amicus, a Law Review, by talking about what is in many ways one of the big stories coming out of Washington, D.C. just this past week, and that is the return by a grand jury, a new grand jury, 26 people newly constituted, plainly having been at work since early July of this year, on a review of evidence to determine whether or not there is probable cause once again to believe that Donald Trump has engaged in crimes in violation of the federal criminal code. We know in particular that there are four counts in the superseded indictment. And we'll talk about exactly how those counts survive into this new plan, this new indictment. But just this past week, Jack Smith, the attorney general, also announcing that a new grand jury, reviewing anew all the evidence in this matter amassed by the FBI, put together by the Department of Justice, reviewing it once again and determining for a second time, again, as a new grand jury, that there is probable cause to believe that Donald Trump has engaged in these particular offense conduct events. And for that reason, returning a new indictment. Superseding simply meaning it overtakes the previous indictment. It substitutes for the previous indictment. And it is now the indictment that will go forward when one day this case is tried before Judge Tanya Chutkan. We'll talk about her and what she has in front of her in just a moment or so. Federal prosecutors, again, through Jack Smith, the special counsel's office, accused Donald Trump, again, through the grand jury, of plotting to overturn the 2020 election. And along the way, they stripped out some of the charges, tweaked others, changed some of the language. Let's talk about exactly what happened with this new superseding indictment along the way. The revised indictment, once again, pending in the federal district court in Washington, D.C., not a new judge, goes right back to the same judge. It's the same case, gets the same number, but nonetheless a new charging document, and is the one upon which the case will now proceed. Keeps the basic structure of that first indictment. You may recall it's been 13, almost 14 months, coming up on 14 months since the initial indictment was returned. Lots of things happening in the interim, including this major appeal to the Supreme Court on the immunity issue. And indeed, that is the principal impact of this decision by the Supreme Court upon the new indictment. The thrust of the charges was to remove any discussion from the indictment, of the old indictment, of allegations that might be construed in some way by the trial judge, by a jury, relating to Donald Trump's official acts as president, while he's also contending that other acts should be interpreted as the conduct of a private candidate for office. That's the tension, if you will,
the Supreme Court has now established. The tone of the new charges in the indictment, as I have reviewed it, is apparent from the very first paragraph of the new indictment. Lots of linguistic changes, not the most significant change, but linguistic changes. For example, Donald Trump described in the initial document as a candidate for president of the United States in 2020. That is now the new first paragraph in the new indictment. The original indictment referred to him as the 45th president of the United States and a candidate for re-election, now making it very clear that this is a candidacy and not something being done in the course of his official conduct. A very significant change along the way. Also throughout the indictment, some changes in describing the ways in which Donald Trump allegedly attempted to remain in power, describing these things as being personal in nature, not official, again, picking up on the language of the Supreme Court decision. Also slightly altering descriptions of six people accused of being co-conspirators and making clear that they are described as private attorneys, not just attorneys as they were in the first document, basically to drive home the point that Donald Trump was acting in his unofficial capacity as a candidate once again for office, not in that official capacity, this distinction that the Supreme Court has underscored in its opinion. So a lot of the language of this throughout the new indictment, the superseding indictment, reflects this notion that these were not official acts. These were not things allegedly done in the course of the president's actual exercise of duties and responsibilities. These were things done in a personal capacity, a private capacity, consistent once again with this bifurcation, this division that the Supreme Court has articulated. The new indictment, of course, also accomplishes this major change, this major omission. It goes from 45 pages down to 36 pages. And one of the principal reasons why you get a more limited document in terms of numbers of pages is just this, is that the grand jury, the new grand jury, has now removed virtually all allegations. And I can remove the word virtual from that last statement. It's removed all allegations about Donald Trump's attempts to strong-arm the Justice Department into supporting these false, unsupported claims that the election had been rigged against him. A major finding in the Supreme Court decision on July 1, this immunity decision, that for presidents involved with communications, engagements with the Department of Justice, stunningly, shockingly, that anything a president does in connection with the Department of Justice, all of that is absolutely immune from prosecution. A shocking notion. Nonetheless, it is now the law in this nation. And as a result of that, compelled as an officer of the court to follow what the law now is, the prosecutor here, Jack Smith, consistent with the grand jury findings, throws out all of that information, all those allegations that indicate that there were communications between Donald Trump and the Department of Justice. Any indications, interactions between officials of the Justice Department and Donald Trump, that's all gone. And instead, we have other things that are left. The indictment also removes references to Trump's conversations with his White House aides and lawyers as well. All of that on the cutting room floor in the wake of all of this. And that is no significant change, almost sending a message to America that the big change between what has happened before the previous indictment and this one is, as a result of what the Supreme Court did, nothing related to Donald Trump's attempts to undermine the voting process, the election, to overthrow the 2020 results, anything related to the Department of Justice, that's all gone. Can't prosecute him, and it's no longer in the indictment, America. That's what Jack Smith is saying because of what the Supreme Court said. He's following the law, but nonetheless, sending the message to America that this is the consequence, not just establishing this sort of notion of presumptive immunities, but major immunities having this great impact. All of that happening just this past week as a result of the grand jury work. As we continue here on Amicus, more examination of this new superseding indictment against Donald Trump here on Amicus, a law review.
This is the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. If you have Labor Day weekend travel plans, don't rush to the roads this morning.
If you are heading out today, maybe wait until the afternoon, late evening. That's going to be the best time to avoid the traffic. The good news, if you're driving, gas prices are looking pretty good right now. It's $3.32. That is down from $3.81 from this time last year.
ABC's Morgan Norwood. 15 ISIS fighters killed Thursday in a joint U.S.-Iraqi raid in western Iraq. No civilian casualties reported. 5 Americans hurt in combat, 2 in falls, and all are in stable condition. Police have arrested a 51-year-old South Carolina man after investigators say he killed a woman who was his roommate and buried her body in a fire pit in his own backyard. 51-year-old Penny Whiteside disappeared in May 2022. Former President Trump's reversal now saying that he will, as a Florida resident, vote no on a ballot measure aiming to overturn the state's near total abortion ban, even though just the day before he indicated the 6-week ban was too restrictive.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
The Packers beat the Ravens. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Packers won their final preseason game 30-7 over the Baltimore Ravens. Green Bay finishing with a preseason record of 2 wins and 1 loss. On defense, the Packers had 4 takeaways, including linebacker Christian Welch, who once played for the Ravens and is a native of Iola, Wisconsin, head coach Matt LaFleur.
He's just a smart, tough, physical player. I thought the interception that he had was an outstanding play. It looked like, to me, he baited the quarterback right there as a hook player and just made a great break on the ball and made the play. And then he had a heck of a return.
Who's going to be the Packers kicker? Greg Olsen and Anders Carlson both had field goals from beyond 50 yards out. Then Carlson missed wide right from just 32 yards out.
Both those guys went in there and hit a 54-yarder and a 55-yarder. And then there's a poor moment there where we miss a chip shot.
Baseball, Brewers and the A's tonight in Oakland. The Crew winning last night 11-3. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, a high near 82. Clear tonight, lows around 60. It'll be breezy out of the northwest, over 25 miles per hour. Sunny and breezy for Sunday with a high near 75. Labor Day Monday, sunshine and highs in the mid-70s.
Currently, 66 degrees.
CapTime's Idea Fest is back for a week of powerhouse speakers and sessions exploring important local and national topics. September 15th through the 21st in Madison. This year's guest speakers include Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, former member of Congress Liz Cheney, Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, and historian Heather Cox Richardson, along with many others. Idea Fest brings together changemakers to discuss Wisconsin's triumphs and failures to help reach a better state. Purchase your tickets today at CapTimesIdeaFest.com to join this premier thought festival.
My son loves to fly kites, but my active psoriatic arthritis can sometimes hold me back. Now with Skyrizi to treat my skin and joints, I'm ready to go. Skyrizi, risankizumab riza, a prescription-only 150 milligram injection for adults, helps with less joint pain, stiffness, swelling, and fatigue. For those who also have plaque psoriasis, 90% clearer skin is possible with just 4 doses a year after 2 starter doses.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
With Skyrizi, there's nothing like clearer skin and better movement, and that means everything. Ask your doctor about Skyrizi today and visit Skyrizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Most people out here think that taking care of one another is important. And most people would step up for a neighbor going through a tough time. Most people around here help out friends and family when they need it. But the funny thing is, most of us won't look for help when we need it. Talk to someone if you're struggling with mental health, because most people out here really care. Find more information at loveyourmindtoday.org. That's loveyourmindtoday.org. Brought to you by the Huntsman Mental Health Institute and the Ad Council.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I'm in my new time slot from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And we'll be doing my show from Madison, where joining me in studio will be award-winning filmmaker and record producer Wendy Schneider.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights from 6 till 8.
Thank you.
This is Amicus Law Review. My name, Jim Santel. Delighted, honored to have you with me in our weekend broadcast. All things rule of law this weekend, all things pleadings in the federal and state courts of our nation, all of them having to do with the prosecution still continuing forward against Donald Trump, both our former president and a present candidate to resume the presidency in January of 2025. What's going on now with this new indictment? Talked in the first segments of our broadcast this weekend about the major implications of the Supreme Court decision. Jack Smith, through the grand jury, cutting out any allegations of improper conduct with respect to Donald Trump and his Justice Department. We know about a lot of those involving Jeffrey Clark, this associate attorney general. We know a lot about those because Donald Trump attempting to convince the Department of Justice to send messages to states around the nation suggesting that there had been an election stolen here. All of that gone, all those communications, all of that attempt to obstruct the processes of voting and counting, all that's gone. The Supreme Court basically dismissing those portions of this indictment. Jack Smith, by virtue of being an officer of the court, eliminating those allegations now from the superseding indictment. For the most part, keeping the structure in place, but all of that absolute immunity having to do with the Department of Justice, all of that's gone from the new indictment. We know as well changes in language, not only to emphasize the personal and private nature of what Donald Trump, but also describing with particularity that very notion, retaining many of the public statements, the statements that Donald Trump himself made on social media and in other settings about the election, and explicitly arguing in this new indictment that those communications to the public should not, cannot be understood as official conduct. Here's what the new indictment, the superseding indictment, says about that. It says, throughout the conspiracies in which Donald Trump and the other unindicted co-conspirators were involved, throughout those conspiracies, although the defendant sometimes used his Twitter account to communicate with the public as president about official actions and policies, he also regularly used it for personal purposes. Again, underscoring the notion there's nothing official about what is alleged in this indictment. Further goes on to say that Donald Trump used social media to, quote, spread knowingly false claims of election fraud, exhort his supporters to travel to Washington, D.C. on January 6th, pressure the vice president to misuse his ceremonial role in the certification proceeding, and leverage the events at the Capitol on January 6th to unlawfully retain power. A lot of good intent language, purpose language there as well. All of that is new in this indictment, once again establishing the very particularized, individualized nature of Donald Trump's conduct, allegedly to retain power. All of that a part of the new indictment. And then, as hinted in that language, a reaffirmation of the engagement, also allegedly illegal, with his vice president, Mike Pence. The allegations against Pence, of course, were principal in the old indictment. They're retained. They're still here in the new indictment, repeatedly emphasizing in the superseding indictment that Mike Pence was also Donald Trump's running mate and in this political setting, and that Donald Trump wanted him to act in his ceremonial capacity as president of the Senate. And that's very important. A role that arguably placed him beyond the reach, right? Beyond the reach of some core executive branch powers and responsibilities. Once again, keeping those allegations about engagements with your vice president in the indictment. Why? Because, as we know under the Constitution, the president is perhaps the one branch of government, is the one branch of government that is not involved in selecting a new president or a continuing president. Yes, the Congress is involved. Yes, indeed, the vice president is involved by virtue of what? By virtue of the fact that the vice president under our Constitution is also the president of the Senate. And so that's why we saw on January 6th, Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi as the Speaker of the House, those two representatives in the well of the House counting ballots that day, suspended by the attack on the Capitol that day, nonetheless resuming late that day. In that role, according to this indictment, the new language in the new charging document, none of that has anything to do with the presidency.
And for that reason, again, these renewed allegations with respect to Donald Trump and his attempts on January 6th, that morning, a conversation with Mike Pence, previous to that, also encouraging him to find that some of those electoral votes, those electoral college votes from the states should be thrown out, that he should indicate that the voting cannot proceed, that the counting of those votes cannot go ahead. All of that, according to the new indictment and the old indictment as well, nothing having to do with an official capacity understanding of what the president does, but instead in a private capacity to try to retain power, using the vice president for that purpose in an area where the president has no official involvement. Interesting, fascinating theory that retains its force from the previous indictment into the present indictment as well. As I said before, much of the other portions of this remain there as well. All the fake electors language, that is still there. The attempts, again, by Donald Trump, the defendant in this case, to try to get these fake electors, as he successfully did. They were not successful in overturning the results of the election, but getting them in place in many states, including right here in Wisconsin, in other states around the nation. All of that fake elector allegation in the federal indictment, that remains. And the connection between Donald Trump and his attempts to get all that in place, that also remains, as do fundamentally the structures of the indictment. The four charges that were confronted by him in the original indictment, he remains accused of overlapping conspiracies to do what? To defraud the United States, to obstruct the certification of the election of the Capitol on January 6th, to deprive millions of Americans of their rights to have their votes properly counted. All of the basic core structure of the indictment remains in place, although once again the language is changed to accomplish this more clear focusing on the personal nature of what Donald Trump allegedly did, and also the elimination of references to the Department of Justice and the beefing up, if you will, the further strengthening of these charges related to not only the vice president, but to fake electors and other people likewise involved in all of this. Those are the principal changes that are now a part of the prosecution going forward. All of this, of course, a result of what the Supreme Court said. The Chief Justice writing in that opinion of July 1, that it's ultimately the government's burden to rebut the presumption of immunity, and said that Judge Shutkin should now take the first crack at assessing, quote, whether a prosecution involving Trump's alleged attempts to influence the vice president's oversight of the certification proceeding in his capacity as president of the Senate would pose any dangers of intrusion on the authority and functions of the executive branch. That's what the Chief Justice wrote. That's the assignment, among other things, now given to Judge Shutkin, the most burdened federal judge in the nation right now because of this assignment, given to her virtually an impossible assignment to try to figure out inside now the superseding indictment what is official, what isn't, to parse all of this out. And in that connection, she has done two things, and let's talk about them now. She has done, number one, a focus upon the specific content of what is before her. And she has said attorneys for the prosecution, Jack Smith and colleagues, and also then attorneys for Donald Trump, I want to hear from all of you, she has said. Tell me what you think this order from the Supreme Court means. Tell me what you think I should do in terms of timing going forward. When should this trial be conducted? Arguably, no less important, what I should do. What is left of this prosecution, even in the wake of the new grand jury indictment? What should survive in the wake of the Supreme Court decision? That's the homework. That's the assignment she gave to them a number of weeks ago. That's the requirement, that is, to submit documents that Jack Smith asked for more time about. He said, I need more time to figure out all of this. And indeed, he got that additional time, as did the defense. And indeed, late on Friday evening of just this past week, everybody submitted what's called a joint report. Now, it's joint in the sense that they all signed off on it, but it's not two or three different documents, but it's one consolidated report in which they express their great differences, their complete disagreement about both timing and substance of what should happen next. Let's talk about exactly what that is all about. Well, what they said was, in this case, that the prosecution obviously will proceed down this road, but in this particular case, Jack Smith says without any doubt that the the court itself, as he said, should have the discretion to manage the timing of this case as it sees fit. He declined specifically to propose a timeline for the case, telling the court instead that, quote, decisions on how to manage its docket are firmly within its own discretion. Trump's lawyers, again, disagreeing with that, among other things, saying that they're going to propose another delay in any in-person proceedings until not only well after the November election, but well into 2025, arguably beyond that. Why? Because of the substance of what the two of them said, completely different views about what should happen and the order in which they should be taken up by the judge. Starkly different views of the case. Prosecutors Jack Smith suggesting that they believe the revised charges should allow them to steer clear of the Supreme Court ruling that the defendant, Donald Trump, is in any way immune from prosecution, even presumptively immune. And of course, Donald Trump's lawyers making clear that they would continue their attacks on the case and push this all far into next year. So what specifically did the prosecutors say about this immunity issue? They said, first of all, you need to take that up initially. That is the threshold issue, they said, Judge Chutkan. You need to take it up. They believe, again, the immunity ruling does not apply to the revised charges they brought against Donald Trump. And they said they're prepared to file a greater explanation, another memorandum of their position, promptly at any time, they said, the court deems appropriate. Donald Trump's lawyers, of course, laid out a much broader vision of how they would like to proceed, a longer vision, saying their attacks would go well beyond just this issue of immunity. Once again, Jack Smith saying, you got to resolve this immunity issue first. You've got to take care of that before we get to anything else. And laying this schedule that would take us well into the fall of next year, 2025, the lawyers told Judge Chutkan that they plan to challenge the indictment on grounds, yes, indeed, once again, that Jack Smith was improperly appointed to his job as special counsel. Now, where did we hear that before? Well, we heard that already in the context of the motion and the order entered by Eileen Cannon. She's a district court judge in South Florida. She's the one who dismissed the Mar-a-Lago documents case on precisely that ground. She found that Jack Smith was not properly appointed by the attorney general. An unsupported, unprecedented decision, turning back literally decades of precedent in our nation. Nonetheless, she dismisses that case, goes up to the 11th Circuit. We'll talk about more of that as our broadcast continues. But using that same argument that was successful, at least for now, in front of Eileen Cannon, the lawyers now in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan raise the same issue. And they say, we want you to resolve that issue first here. Find, on behalf of Donald Trump, they're saying that Jack Smith cannot proceed with the prosecution improperly, unconstitutionally appointed by the attorney general. Of course, the government going to push back as it has before on that notion. But once again, indicating how very different the views are about what should happen here. The Donald Trump lawyers also saying they might have to seek to have the election case thrown out by arguing that the prosecutors also overreached when they used this federal obstruction statute to accuse Donald Trump of disrupting the certification process. That's the Fisher argument. That's the argument under Section 1512. We've talked a lot about this as well. That's the case in which the Supreme Court, unrelated to, but maybe somewhat related to the immunity case, that's the Fisher case. We'll chat more about that in just a minute or so, which the Supreme Court says that in order to prosecute under Section 1512, which the government is doing against Donald Trump, in addition to many others, you got to bring forth some indication of documents and papers and materials, physical items. And the Trump lawyers saying that based upon the Fisher decision by the Supreme Court, Judge Chutkan, you also have to throw out all of these cases, all aspects of the present case in front of you, in front of the federal district court there, based upon the decision of the Supreme Court in Fisher. It is a lot. And it is a lot to consume. The Trump lawyer is pulling out all the stops, if you will, and saying we're going to invoke all of this related to the authority of the prosecutor to proceed, and also this Fisher case as well. And all of that going to lead up to what Tanya Chutkan does next. We'll talk about all that as Amicus, a law review, continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
As a federally licensed broadcast company, this civic media station is required by FCC regulations to accept advertising by all qualified candidates for federal office. We also accept ads from state and local candidates. We do screen announcements from issue groups and PACs and exercise discretion in airing announcements with blatantly false claims or outrageous unfounded statements. These announcements do not necessarily reflect the views of civic media, its hosts, or advertisers, and the source of all issue announcements can be found online at our FCC public file.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
A heads up before something bad happens.
You should not send that text.
Uh-oh. Life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes, you can reverse prediabetes and prevent or delay type 2 diabetes. To learn your risk, take the one-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its prediabetes awareness partners.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
This is Amicus, a law review. This is the end of our first hour here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media, talking about what's going on this past week, the filings of the attorneys before federal judge Tanya Chutkan. Noting along the way the very strong differences, the substantive differences, not only in terms of timing, but also substance of how Tanya Chutkan should proceed in this case, not giving her a unified, unanimous agreement on what should happen here, thus presenting to her even more controversy as this case goes forward. Significantly, Jack Smith indicating, subject of a lot of speculation here, that he does not think that the court has to engage in any sort of mini trials. No evidentiary hearings, he said, need to be done in this case. We don't need to call any witnesses. Nobody comes forward as a part of this. Smith instead urging Tanya Chutkan to accept just written briefs, as I said before. Written briefs, memorandums. We can describe for you in writing, Judge, in another submission to you, why it is we feel strong that there's nothing about the immunity decision by the Supreme Court that should change now. The new indictment, that you can go forward and try this case. We'll explain that all in this larger brief. We do not need any evidentiary hearing, no mini trial, no proceeding in which you call witnesses and ask for their testimony. Instead, we can do that. We can distinguish Donald Trump's private electioneering activity from his official action, Jack Smith says. And if Trump files motions on other issues, Smith has asked the court to consider those simultaneously with the immunity issue. Now, the defense attorneys, again, have said, oh, yes, we're going to file lots of motions here. We're not only going to challenge the interpretation of immunity, but we're going to say that, Jack Smith, you've got no authority. And by the way, this Fisher case prevents you from going ahead with at least a couple of those charges along the way. All these kinds of things going to be a part of the presentation by the defense. That is their right. That is their absolute right under our system. And it makes the cases stronger, if you will, as I've often argued here on our broadcast. It ensures that the government is put to its test, and that if in the end there is a conviction of a defendant, in this case Donald Trump, we know with some certainty that the process has worked, that the adversarial system has worked, and that's what all this pretrial motion practice is all about. Donald Trump's attorney is saying, no, we need much greater period of time, put this well into next year, if not beyond. And also take up these other issues before you get to immunity, or at least do them simultaneously with all of our other proceedings. Those schedules, of course, going to be the subject of what's happening next. And that is that Tanya Chutkan has also done something else. And that something else is that she has scheduled a hearing for this coming week. That's right, September 5th, Thursday, September 5th. Tanya Chutkan, now having received all these written pleadings of the parties, she is now going to call all of them in. Counsel, come into my courtroom and appear in front of me. The first time since the Supreme Court has issued its opinion in this immunity decision on July 1, the first time that anybody has been brought together in the same forum, happening in Judge Tanya Chutkan's courtroom this coming week. A proceeding that, of course, will not be televised, but once again, the media will be there. We'll get the sketches of all the goings-on in that court. And we will also get a lot of reporting, of course, on what exactly it is. We can also get the transcripts of what's said.
Needless to say, the attorneys will probably tell Judge Tanya Chutkan exactly what they've already written to her, pleadings and motions and documents filed with her just late this past week. And now she is going to wrestle with them, probably ask them, sort of in the nature of oral argument, what do you mean by this? No evidentiary hearing this coming week. And indeed, the prosecution is going to argue against any of that at any time. But she's going to ask both sides and quiz them on the nature of their proposals, both in terms of timing and substance. How do I go about doing this? And plainly, we've got very, very, very different views about what happens next in all of this. Judge Chutkan is going to resolve that presumably at some point yet this fall, maybe predictably before the election. She will perhaps even ask them about the scheduling of a trial. When can we do all this? When can we have a resolution of these pretrial matters? When can I get to all of this in such a way that I can finally schedule a trial in this? You recall well that this case was actually first scheduled for trial way back in March of this year, suspended when Donald Trump took an appeal to the Supreme Court on the immunity issue, and it's been since that time that Tanya Chutkan has been able to do anything in this case. Now she is back in business and having this hearing on Thursday, September 5th. Big news story coming up this week, undeniably, as this case proceeds. Filings by attorneys on the language of what should happen in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling, in the wake of the superseding indictment, how that language is supposed to be interpreted, what the judge should do, and then what is the timing on all this? Maybe even establishing, although it's not clear right now if it will stick, maybe even establishing for the second time in this matter a trial date, presumably sometime well into 2025, could even be beyond that if there are further what's called our interlocutory appeals, other appeals from Judge Tanya Chutkan. She's got a lot of work in front of her, not only in the hearing, but also to straighten all this out. This amazing thing that the United States Supreme Court said for the first time in our history, that a president is immune for certain kinds of things, and imposing upon Jack Smith this incredible newly designed burden to establish that the prosecution, even with respect to the presumptions of immunity, will not have an impact upon the conduct of the presidency. Well, of course it will. Any single criminal prosecution, any civil litigation has an impact. Be interesting to hear what the attorneys say to Judge Chutkan about that and the burden that will show. Jack Smith plainly coming up with lots and lots of theories with respect to the Fisher argument alone, not only in the superseding indictment, but he also says, of course, as he goes forward, that he's got a response to Fisher, and he is going to say plainly that Donald Trump is subject to prosecution under that section. Why? Because he also was having an impact upon precisely the kinds of materials and documents and papers the Supreme Court has said you've got to have in order to proceed under that statute. What are those documents and papers? Those are ballots. Those are electoral votes. Those are ballots in the states of our union. Those are the papers by which we vote. And that's what Jack Smith is going to be arguing this coming Thursday. Already has argued that nothing about the Fisher case should prevent the prosecution. Nothing about that immunity case. Now that he's stripped away the absolute immunity from the Department of Justice, tweaked other aspects of this, nothing about any of that should have an impact upon the courts now resolving this. And he, of course, is advocating that the immunity decision, now that the indictment has been changed and altered, nothing about that immunity decision of July 1 prevents the case from going ahead on all four counts of the indictment. And the trial can, in fact, proceed. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, more on all of this in our discussion of cases and trials in the courts of America.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allbaugh Show.
Todd Allbaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time for a special Labor Day edition of the show. We'll look back at Wisconsin history and Labor Day. Be with us then.
The Todd Allbaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Carter's Collision in Kewaunee takes this time to remind us to salute our emergency first responders, law enforcement, firefighters, and paramedics for their professionalism, commitment, and bravery. They are willing to put their lives on the line for hours with little or no thanks. First responders are the backbone of our country. They deserve our admiration, so thank them for everything they do for us. This message is from Carter's Collision in Kewaunee, supporting our first responders because when we call, they answer.
Enjoying this local program?
Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.